Tom and Dorian found the last wagon descending the final slope of the dunes. The women were walking beside it. Sarah had relit the lantern and held it high when she heard the horses galloping up. "Will you not hurry, woman?" Tom was so agitated that he shouted at her from a distance. "We are hurrying," she replied, "and your rough seaman's language will make us go no faster. We have delayed Kayser for the moment, but he will be after us again soon enough." Tom realized his mistake in adopting that brusque approach to his wife, and despite his agitation tried to ameliorate his tone. "We are in sight of the beach, and all your possessions are safe," he pointed ahead. "Will you now let me take you to the boat, my sweeting?" She looked up at him, and even in the poor light of her lantern could see the strain on his face. She relented. "Lift me up then, Tom." She raised her arms to him like a small girl to her father. When he swung her up and placed her behind him, she hugged him close and whispered into the thick curls that bushed down the back of his neck, "You are the finest husband God ever placed upon this earth, and I am the most fortunate of wives." Dorian gathered up Yasmini, and they followed Tom down to where Mansur waited with the lighter at the water's edge. They placed the two women firmly on board. The wagon came trundling down, and as it reached the lighter it sank axle-deep into the wet sand, but this made it easier to transfer the last of their possessions into the boat. Once the wagon was empty, the oxen were able to haul it away. While this was going on, Tom and Dorian kept glancing back into the darkness of the dunes, expecting the worst of Kayser's threats to materialize. But the harpsichord was at last lashed down and covered with a tarpaulin to protect it from the spray. Mansur and the crewman, who were shoving out the boat, were still waist-deep when there was an angry shout from the dunes and the flash and clap of a carbine shot. The ball slammed into the transom of the boat, and Mansur leapt in. There was another shot, and again the ball struck the hull. Tom pushed the women down until they were sitting on the deck, in an inch or more of bilge water, protected by the pile of hastily loaded cargo. "I entreat you now to keep your heads well down. We can argue the merits of this suggestion later. However, I assure you those are real musket balls." He looked back and could just make out Kayser's distinctive outline against the pale sand, but his stentorian bellows carried clearly. "You will not escape me, Tom Courtney. I shall see you hanged, drawn, and quartered on the same scaffold as that bloody pirate, your grandfather. Every Dutch port in this world would be closed to you." "Take no notice of what he says," Tom told Sarah, dreading that Kayser would repeat his gruesome description of Jim's fate and torment her beyond bearing. "In his pique he utters only monstrous lies. Come on, let us give him a farewell tune." To drown Kayser's threats, he launched into a hearty but off-key rendition of Spanish Ladies, and the others all joined in. Dorian's voice was as magnificent as ever, and Mansur had inherited his ringing tenor. Yasmini's soprano lisped sweetly. Sarah leaned against Tom's reassuring bulk and sang with him. "Farewell and adieu to you, fair Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu to you, ladies from Spain. For we've received orders to sail for Old England, but we hope in a short time to see you again. Then let every man here toss off a full bumper. Then let every man here toss off his full bowl. For we will be jolly and drown melancholy, with a health to each jovial and true-hearted soul." Yasmini laughed and clapped her hands. "That's the first naughty song Dorry ever taught me. Do you remember when first I sang it to you, Tom?" "My oath on it, I'll never forget it," Tom chuckled as he steered for the Maid of York. "'Twas the day you brought Dorry back to me after I had lost him for all those years." As Tom clambered aboard the Maid of York, he gave orders to his captain. "Captain Cumra, in God's name, get this last load on board as quick as you like." He went back to the rail and looked down at Dorian, who was still in the lighter. He called to him, "As soon as you are on board the Gift of Allah, douse all lights and hoist anchor. We must be clear of the land before first light. I don't want Kayser and the Dutch lookouts in the castle to spy out in which direction we are headed. Let them guess whether it be east or west or even south to the pole." The last of the baggage to come on board from the lighter was Sarah's harpsichord. As it dangled over the side, Tom called to the men on the fall of the tackle. "A guinea for the man who lets that damn thing drop down to Davy Jones." Sarah prodded him sharply in the ribs, and the crewmen paused and looked at each other. They were never sure what to make of Tom's sense of humour. Tom put his arm around Sarah and went on, "Of course, once you have your guinea, out of deference to the feeling of my wife, I shall be obliged to throw you in after it." They laughed uncertainly and swung the harpsichord inboard. Tom strode back to the side. "Be away with you then, brother," he called to Dorian. The crew of the lighter shoved off, and Dorian hailed back. "If we become separated in the dark, then the rendezvous will be off Cape Hanclip, as always." "As always, Dorry." The two ships sailed within minutes of each other, and for the first hour they were able to keep station. Then the wind increased to near gale force, and the last sliver of moon went behind the clouds. In the darkness they lost contact with each other. When dawn broke, the maid found herself alone, with the southeaster howling through her rigging. The land was a blue smear, low on the northern horizon, almost obscured by the breaking waves and the swirling sea fret. "Fat chance that the Dutch will make us out in this weather," Tom shouted at Cumra, as the tails of the tarpaulin coat flapped around his legs, and the ship heeled over to the push of the storm. "Make this your offing, and come about for Cape Hanclip." Close-hauled against the storm, they raised the cape the next morning, and found the gift there before them, beating back and forth on the rendezvous. Once more in convoy, they set out eastwards to round Cape Orgullis, the southernmost tip of Africa. The wind held steadily out of the east. They spent many weary days tacking back and forth, steering clear of the treacherous shoals that guarded Orgullis, and clawing their way into their easterlies. At last they were able to double the cape and turn northwards along that rugged and inhospitable coast. 3 weeks after leaving High Weald, they finally passed through the heads of grey rock that guarded the great lagoon of the elephants. They dropped anchor in the blessedly calm waters, clear as good Holland's gin, and teeming with shoals of fish. "This is where my grandfather Frankie Courtney fought his last battle with the Dutch. Here they made him prisoner and took him down to Good Hope to perish on the gallows," he told Sarah. "My sacred oath, they were tough old devils, those ancestors of mine," he said with pride. Sarah smiled at him. "Are you suggesting that you are a milquetoast and a caitiff when compared with them?" Then she shaded her eyes and peered up at the hillside that rose above the lagoon. "Is that your famous post-stone?" Halfway up the hill, a prominent lump of grey stone the size of a hayrick had been painted with a large, lopsided letter P in scarlet paint, so that it was visible to any ship anchored in the lagoon. "Oh, take me ashore immediately. I feel certain that there is a letter from Jim awaiting us." Tom was certain that her hopes were doomed to disappointment, but they rowed to the beach in the longboat. Sarah was first over the side, with the water reaching to her thighs and soaking her skirts. Tom had difficulty keeping up with her as she lifted the sodden cloth to her knees and scrambled up the hillside. "Look," she cried, "someone has placed a cairn of stones on the summit. That surely is a sign that a letter is waiting for us." A hollow space had been burrowed out beneath the post-stone, and the entrance to it was blocked with smaller ones. She pulled these apart, and beyond them she found a bulky parcel. It was stitched up in a wrapper of heavy tarpaulin and sealed with tar. "I knew it! Oh, yes, I knew it!" Sarah sang, as she dragged the parcel from its hiding place. But when she read the inscription on it, her face fell. Without another word, she handed the packet to Tom and started back down the hill. Tom read the inscription. It was in an ill-formed hand, misspelled and crude. "Hail, you true and worthy soul who doth this missive find. Take it with you to London town, and give it over to Nicholas Watt Esquire at 51 Wacker Street, close by the East India Dock. He shall give you a guinea for it. Open not this packet. Fail me never. If you do so, then I do rot your balls and damn your eyes. May your mannequin never rise, you godforsaken bogger." The message was signed, "Captain Noah Calder, aboard the brig Larkspur, outbound for Bombay, 21st of May, in the year of our Lord Jesus, 1731. "Words well chosen and sentiments sweetly expressed," Tom smiled, as he replaced the packet in the recess and covered it with the stones. "I am not headed for old London town, so I will not risk the dire consequences of failure. It must wait for a bolder soul heading in the right direction." He went down the hill, and halfway to the beach he found Sarah sitting forlornly upon a rock. She turned away as he sat down beside her and tried to stifle her sobs. He took her face between his big hands and turned it towards him. "No, no, no, my love. You must not take on so. Our Jim is safe." "Oh, Tom, I was so sure it was his letter to us, and not that of some oaf of a sailor." "It was most unlikely that he would come here. Surely he will be heading further north. I do believe he had set upon Nativity. We shall find him there, and little Louisa with him, mark my words. Nothing can befall our Jim. He is a Courtney, 10 feet tall and made from billets of cast iron covered with elephant hide." She laughed through her tears. "Oh, Tom, you silly man, you should be upon the stage." "Even Master Garrick could not afford my fee," he laughed with her. "Come along now, my own sweet girl. There's no profit in pining, and there is work to do if we purpose to sleep ashore this night." They went back down to the beach and found that Dorian and his party from the Gift had already come ashore. Mansur was unloading the water casks into the longboat. He would refill them from the sweet water stream that flowed into the top end of the lagoon. Dorian and his men were building shelters on the edge of the forest, weaving frameworks of saplings. They were thatching these with new seeds, fresh cut from the edge of the water. The smell of sweet sap perfumed the air. After the trying weeks at sea in rough weather, the women needed comfortable quarters on dry land in which to recuperate. It was over a year since the brothers had visited the lagoon on their last trading expedition along the coast. The huts they had built then, they had burned to the ground when they sailed, for by now they would have been infested by scorpions, hornets, and other unpleasant flying insects and crawling creatures. There was a brief alarum when they heard a succession of musket shots banging out from the top end of the lagoon, but Dorian reassured them quickly. "I told Mansur to bring us in fresh meat. He must have found game." When Mansur returned with the refilled water casks, he brought with him the carcass of a half-grown buffalo. Despite its tender age, the beast was the size of an ox, enough to feed them all for weeks once it was salted and smoked. Then the other longboat returned from the edge of the channel, where Tom had sent 5 of the crew to catch fish. The bins amidship were filled with sparkling silver mounds, still quivering and twitching. Sarah and Yasmini set to work at once with their servants to prepare a suitable feast to celebrate their arrival. They ate under the stars, with sparks from the campfire rising into the dark sky in a torrent. After they had eaten their fill, Tom sent for Batula and Kumra. They came ashore from the anchored ships and took their places, sitting cross-legged on their prayer mats in the circle around the fire. "I ask your forgiveness for any disrespect," Tom greeted the two captains. "We should have heard the news you bring sooner than this. However, with the need to sail from Good Hope with such dispatch, and the gale that has sailed us since then, there has been no opportunity." "It is as you say, Effendi," Batula, the senior captain, replied. "We are your men, and there was never any disrespect." The servants brought coffee from the fire in brass kettles, and Dorian and the Arabs lit their hookahs. The water in the bowls bubbled with each breath of the perfumed Turkish tobacco smoke they drew. First they discussed the trade and the goods that the captains had gathered during their last voyage along this coast. As Arabs, they were able to travel where no Christian ship was allowed to pass. They had even sailed on past the Horn of Hormuz into the Red Sea, as far as Holy Medina, the luminous city of the Prophet. On their return journey, they had parted company, Kumra in the Maid turning eastwards to call in at the ports of the Empire of the Moguls, there to deal with the diamond merchants from the Kollar mines, and to buy bales of silken rugs from the souks of Bombay and Delhi. Meanwhile, Batula sailed along the Coromandel coast and loaded his ship with tea and spices. The two ships met again in the harbour of Trincomalee in Ceylon. There they took on board cloves, saffron, coffee beans, and choice packets of blue star sapphires. Then, in company, they had returned to Good Hope to the anchorage off the beach of High Weald. Batula was able to recite from memory the quantities of each commodity they had purchased, the prices they had paid, and the state of the various markets they had visited. Tom and Dorian questioned them carefully and exhaustively, while Mansair wrote everything in the CBTC journal. This information was vital to their prosperity. Any change in the state and condition of the markets and the supply of goods could spell great profit or perhaps even greater disaster to their enterprise. "The largest profits will lie in the commerce of slaves," Kumra summed up delicately, and neither captain could meet Tom's eye as he said it. They knew his views on their trade, which he called an abomination in the face of God and man. Predictably, Tom rounded on Kumra. "The only piece of human flesh I will ever sell is your hairy buttocks to the first man who will pay the 5 rupees I ask for them." "Effendi," cried Kumra, his expression a thespian masterpiece, an unlikely mixture of contrition and pained sensibility, "I would rather shave off my beard and feast on pig flesh than buy a single human soul from the slave block." Tom was about to remind him that slaving had been his chief enterprise before he entered the service of the Courtney brothers, when Dorian, playing the peacemaker, intervened smoothly. "I hunger for news of my old home. Tell me what you have learned of Omani and Muscat, of Lamu and Zanzibar." "We knew that you would ask us this, so we have saved this news for the last. Those lands have been overtaken by momentous events, Al-Salil." They turned to Dorian eagerly, grateful to him for having diverted Tom's wrath. "Good captains, tell us all you have learned," Yasmini demanded. Until now she had sat behind her husband and held her peace, as a dutiful Muslim wife should. Now, however, she could restrain herself no longer, for they were speaking of her homeland and her family. Although she and Dorian had fled the Zanzibar coast almost 20 years ago, her thoughts often returned there, and her heart hankered for the lost years of her childhood. It was true indeed that not all of her memories were happy ones. There had been times of loneliness in the isolation of the women's zenana. Although she had been born a princess, daughter of Sultan Abd Muhammad al-Malik, the caliph of Muscat, her father had possessed more than 50 wives. He showed interest only in his sons, and could never bother himself to keep track of his daughters. She knew that he was barely aware of her existence, and could not remember any word he had spoken to her, or even a touch of his hand or a kindly glance. In all truth, she had laid eyes on him only on state occasions or when he visited his women in the Zenana. Then it had been only at a distance, and she had trembled and covered her face in terror of his magnificence and his godlike presence. Even so, she mourned and fasted the full 40 days and nights stipulated by the prophet when news of his death reached her in the African wilderness, whence she had fled with Dorian. Her mother had died in Yasmini's infancy, and she could not remember a single detail about her. As she grew older, she learned that she had inherited from her the startling streak of silver hair that divided her own thick midnight black tresses. Yasmini had spent all her childhood in the Zenana on Lamu Island. The only maternal love she had known was given to her unstintingly by Tahi, the old slave woman who had nursed her and Dorian. In the beginning, Dorian, the adopted son of her own father, was with her in the Zenana. This was before he reached his puberty and underwent the ordeal of the circumcision knife. As her adopted elder brother, he protected her, often with his fists and feet, from the malice of her blood brothers. Her particular tormentor was Zayn al-Din. When Dorian defended her, he had made a mortal enemy of him. The rancor would persist throughout their lives, to this day. Yasmini remembered that dire confrontation between the two boys in every detail. Dorian and Zayn had been only a few months short of puberty, and their departure from the Zenana and entry into manhood and military service was looming large. That day Yasmini was playing alone on the terrace of the old saint's tomb at the end of the Zenana gardens. This was one of her secret places where she could escape from the bullying of their peers and find solace in daydreams and childish games of fantasy. With Yasmini was her pet vervet monkey, Jinni. Zayn al-Din and Abu Bakr, both her half-brothers, had discovered her there. plump, sly and vicious. Zane was bravest when he had one of his toadies with him. He wrested the little monkey from Yasmini and threw him into the open rainwater cistern. Though Yasmini screamed at the top of her lungs and jumped on his back, pummeling his head and trying to scratch lumps out of his skin, he ignored her and began systematically to drown Ginny, ducking the monkey's head each time he surfaced. Summoned by Yasmini's screams, Dorian came racing up the staircase from the garden. He took in the scene at a glance, then launched himself at the two bigger boys. Before his capture by the Arabs, his brother Tom had coached Dorian in the art of boxing. But Zane and Abu Bakr had never before come into contact with bunched flying fists. Abu Bakr fled from this terrible attack, but Zane's nose burst in a spray of scarlet at the first punch, while the second sent him somersaulting down the steep staircase. When he struck the bottom, one of the bones in his right foot snapped. The bone set ill, and he would limp for the rest of his life. In the years after he had left behind his childhood and the Zenana, Dorian had become a prince in his own right and a famous warrior. Yasmini, however, was forced to remain behind at the mercy of Kush, the head eunuch. Even after all these years, his monstrous cruelty lived vividly in her memory. Yasmini grew to lovely womanhood, while Dorian fought his adopted father's enemies in the Arabian deserts far to the north. Covered in glory, he had returned at last to Lamu, but he had almost forgotten his adopted sister and childhood sweetheart. Then Tahi, his ancient slave nurse, had come to him in the palace and reminded him that Yasmini was still languishing in the Zenana. With Tahi as a go-between, they had arranged a dangerous tryst. When they became lovers, they were committing a double sin from the consequences of which not even Dorian's exalted position could protect them. They were adopted brother and sister, and in the eyes of God, the Caliph, and the Council of Mullahs, their union was both fornication and incest. Kush had discovered their secret, and planned a punishment for Yasmini, so unspeakably cruel that she still shuddered when she thought about it, but Dorian had intervened to save her. He killed Kush and buried him in the grave the eunuch had dug for Yasmini. Then Dorian disguised her as a boy and smuggled her out of the harem. Together they escaped from Lamu. Many years later, after his father, Abd Muhammad al-Malik, had died of poisoning, Zayn, still limping from the injury Dorian had inflicted, ascended the elephant throne of Oman. One of his first acts as caliph was to send Abu Bakr to find and capture Dorian and Yasmini. When Abu Bakr caught up with the lovers, there had been a terrible battle in which Dorian had killed him. Yasmini and Dorian had escaped, once again, from Zayn's vengeance, and been reunited with Tom. However, Zayn al-Din sat on the mighty elephant throne to this day, and was still Caliph of Oman. They knew they were never entirely safe from his hatred. Now, sitting by the campfire on this wild and savage shore, she reached out to touch Dorian. It was almost as though he had read her thoughts, for he took her hand and held it firmly. She felt strength and courage flowing from him into her, like the balmy influence of the Kuzi, the trade wind of the Indian Ocean. "Recount," Dorian ordered his captains. "Tell me these momentous tidings you bring from Muscat. Did you hear aught of the Caliph, Zayn al-Din?" "Our tidings are all of Zayn al-Din. As Allah bears witness, he is Caliph in Muscat no longer." "What is this you say?" Dorian started up. "Is Zayn dead at last?" "Nay, my prince, a shaitan is hard to kill. Zayn al-Din lives on." "Where is he, then? We must know all of this affair." "Forgive me, Effendi." Batulo made a gesture of deep respect, touching his lips and his heart. "There is one in our present company who knows all this far better than I do. He comes from the bosom of Zayn al-Din, and was once one of his trusted ministers and confidants." "Then he is no friend of mine. His master has tried on many occasions to kill me and my wife. It was Zayn who drove us into exile. He is my mortal enemy, and he has sworn a blood feud against us." "All this I know well, Lord," Batulo replied, for I have been with you since that happy day when the man who then was Caliph, your sainted adoptive father Al-Malik, made me your lance-bearer. Do not forget that I was at your side when you captured Zayn al-Din at the Battle of Muscat, and you roped him behind your camel, and dragged him as a traitor to face the wrath and justice of Al-Malik. That I will never forget, as I will not forget your loyalty and service to me over all these years. Dorian's expression became sad. Pity it is that my father's wrath was so short-lived, and his justice too heavily tempered with mercy, for he pardoned Zayn al-Din and clasped him once again to his bosom. By God's holy name, Batula's anger matched that of his master. Your father died from that show of mercy. It was Zayn's effeminate hand that held the poisoned cup to his lips. And Zayn's fat buttocks that sat on the elephant throne when my father was gone. Dorian's handsome features were marred by an expression of ferocity. Now you ask me to accept into my camp the minion and minister of this monster? Not so, Highness. I said that this man was once all those things to Zayn al-Din, but no longer. Like all who know him well, he became sickened to the heart by the monstrous cruelty of Zayn al-Din. He watched while Zayn tore the sinews and the heart of the nation to shreds. He watched helplessly while Zayn fed his pet sharks with the flesh of good and noble men, until they were almost too bloated to swim. He tried to protest when Zayn sold his birthright to the Sublime Porte, to the Turkish tyrants in Constantinople. In the end, he was one of the chief conspirators in the plot against Zayn that overturned his throne and drove him out through the gates of Muscat.
Zayn is overthrown? Dorian stared at Batula in astonishment. He was Caliph for 20 years. I thought he would stay in power until he died of old age.
Some men of great evil possess not only the savagery of the wolf, but also that beast's instincts of survival. This man, Kadim al-Khuf, will tell you the rest of the story, if you will allow it.
Dorian glanced at Tom, who had been following every word with intense interest.
What do you think, brother?
Let us hear the man's story, Tom said. Kadim al-Khuf must have been awaiting their summons, for he came within minutes from the crew's encampment at the edge of the forest. They all realized that they had seen him often during the stormy voyage up from Good Hope. Although they had not known his name, they had understood that he was Batula's newly hired writer and purser.
Kadim al-Khuf, Dorian greeted him, you are a guest in my camp. You are under my protection.
Your beneficence lights my life like the sunrise, Prince al-Salil ibn al-Malik. Kadim prostrated himself before Dorian. May the peace of God and the love of his last true prophet follow you all the days of your long and illustrious life.
It is many years since any man has called me by that title, Dorian nodded, gratified. Rise up, Kadim, and take a place in our council.
Kadim sat beside Batula, his sponsor.
The servants brought him coffee in a silver cup, and Batula passed him the ivory mouthpiece of his pipe.
Both Dorian and Tom studied the new man carefully, while he enjoyed these expressions of hospitality and favour.
Kadim al-Khuf was young, no more than a few years older than Mansur. He had a noble face. His features reminded Dorian of his own adoptive father. Of course, it was not impossible that he was a royal bastard. The Caliph had been a man indeed, and prolific with his seed. He had ploughed and sowed wherever the ground pleased him. Dorian smiled faintly, then put aside the thought, and once more regarded Kadim with his full attention. His skin was the colour of fine polished teak. His brow was deep and wide, his eyes clear, dark, and penetrating. He returned Dorian's scrutiny calmly, and despite his protestations of loyalty and respect, Dorian thought he recognised in his gaze the disconcerting gleam of the zealot. This is a man who lives by the word of Allah alone, he thought. Here is one who places scant value in the law and opinions of men. He knew well how dangerous such men could be. While he composed his next question, he looked at Kadem's hands. There were tell-tale calluses on his fingers and his right palm. He recognized these as the stigmata of the warrior, the gall of bowstring and sword hilt. He looked again at his shoulders and arms and saw the development of muscle and sinew that could only have been built up during long hours of practice with bow and blade. Dorian let none of these thoughts show in his own eyes as he asked gravely, "You were in the service of Caliph Zayn al-Din?"
"Since childhood, Lord. I was an orphan, and he took me under his protection."
"You swore a blood oath of loyalty to him?" Dorian insisted. For the first time, Kedem's steady gaze shifted slightly. He did not reply.
"Yet you have reneged on this oath," Dorian persisted. "Batula tells me you are no longer the Caliph's man. Is that true?"
"Your Highness, I swore that oath nearly 12 years ago, on the day of my circumcision. In those days I was a man in name only, but in reality I was a mere child and a stranger to the truth."
"And now I can see that you have become a man," Dorian went on, appraising him. Kadam was supposedly a writer, a man of papers and ink, but he did not have that look. There was a latent fierceness about him, like a falcon at roost. Dorian was intrigued. He went on, "But, Kadam al-Juf, does this release you from a blood oath of fealty?"
"My lord, I believe that fealty is a dagger with two edges. He who accepts it has a responsibility towards he who offers it. If he neglects that duty and responsibility, then the debt is cancelled."
"These are devious semantics, Kadam. I find them too convoluted to fathom. To me, an oath is an oath."
"My lord condemns me?" Kadam's voice was silky, but his eyes were cold as obsidian.
"Nay, Kadam al-Juf, I leave judgment and condemnation to God."
"Bismillah," Kedem intoned, and Batula and Kumra stirred.
"There is no God but God," said Batula.
"God's wisdom surpasses all understanding," said Kumra.
Kedem whispered, "Yet I know that Zayn al-Din is your blood enemy. That is why I come to you, al-Salil."
"Yes, Zayn is my adopted brother and my enemy. Many years ago he swore to kill me. Many times since then I have felt his baleful influence touch my life," Dorian agreed.
"I have heard him relate to his courtiers how he owes his crippled foot to you," Kadam went on.
"He owes me much else besides," Dorian smiled. "I had the great pleasure of placing a rope around his neck and dragging him before our father to face the Caliph's wrath."
"Posterity and Zayn al-Din remember this deed of yours well," Kadam nodded. "This is part of the reason that we chose to come to you."
"Before it was I, but now it is we?"
"There are others who have repudiated their oaths of fealty to Zayn al-Din. We turn to you, for you are the last of the line of Abd Muhammad al-Malik."
"How is that possible?" Dorian demanded, and suddenly he was angry. "My father had countless wives who bore him sons, and they in turn had sons and grandsons. My father's seed was fruitful."
"Fruitful no longer. Zayn has harvested all his father's fruits. On the first day of Ramadan there was such a slaughter as to shame the face of God and astound all Islam. 200 of your brothers and nephews were gathered up by Zayn al-Din's reapers. They died by poison, that coward's tool, and they died by steel and rope and water. Their blood soaked the desert sands and tinted the sea to rose. Every person who had a blood claim to the elephant throne in Muscat perished in that holy month. Murder was compounded 10,000 times by sacrilege."
Dorian stared at him in horrified disbelief, and Yasmini choked back her sobs. Her brothers and other kin must be among the dead. Dorian put aside his own shocked grief to comfort her. He stroked the silver blaze that shone like a diadem in her sable locks, and whispered softly to her before he turned back to Kedem.
"This is hard news and bitter," he said. "It takes great effort for the mind to encompass such evil."
"My lord, neither were we able to treat with such monstrous evil. That is why we repudiated our vows and rose up against Zayn al-Din."
"There has been a rising?"
Although Batula had already warned him of this, Dorian wanted Kedem to confirm it. All this seemed too far beyond the frontiers of possibility.
"A battle raged within the walls of the city for many days. Zayn al-Din and his adherents were driven into the keep of the fort. We believed that they would perish there, but alas, there was a secret tunnel under the walls that led down to the old harbour. Zayn escaped by this route, and his ships bore him away.
"Whither did he flee?" Dorian demanded.
"He sailed back to his birthplace on Lamu Island. With the help of the Portuguese and the collusion of the minions of the English East India Company at Zanzibar, he has seized the great fort and all the Omani settlements and possessions along the Fever Coast. Under the threat of the English guns, his forces in those possessions have remained loyal to him and have resisted our efforts to cast down the tyrant."
"In God's name, you and your junta in Muscat must be preparing your fleet to exploit these successes and to attack Zayn in Zanzibar and Lamu. Is that not so?" Dorian demanded.
"My lord prince, our ranks are riven by dissent. There is no successor of royal blood to head our junta. Thus we lack loyal support from the Omani nation. In particular, the desert tribes are hesitating to declare against Zayn and join our standard."
Dorian's expression became wooden and remote as he realized where Kadam's protestations were heading.
"Without a leader, our cause grows weaker and more divided each day, while each day Zayn regains his stature and strength. He commands the Zanzibar coast. We have learned that he has sent envoys to the great Mughal, the supreme emperor in Delhi, and to the sublime Porte in Constantinople. His old allies are rallying to support him. Soon all of Islam and Christendom will unite against us. Our victory will drain away into the sands, like the ebb of the spring tide."
"What do you want from me, Kadam al-Juff?" Dorian asked softly.
"We need a leader with a rightful claim to the elephant throne," Kadam replied. "We need a tried warrior who has commanded the desert tribes in battle, the Saar, the Daham, and the Karab, and the Bait Katir, and the Awamir, but most of all the Harassis, who hold within their sway the plains of Muscat. Without these, there can be no ultimate victory."
Dorian sat quietly, but his heart had beaten faster as Kadam recited those illustrious names. In his mind's eye he saw again the battle array, the glint of steel in the dust clouds and the banners unfurled. He heard the war cries of the riders, "Allah Akbar, God is great," and the roaring of the ranks of camels racing onwards across the sands of Oman. Yasmini felt his arm tremble under her hand, and her heart quailed. "I believed in my heart that the dark days were past forever," she thought, "that I might never again hear the beat of the war drum. I hoped that my husband would always stay beside me and never again ride away to war." The company was silent, each of them thinking their own thoughts. Kadam was watching Dorian with that glittering, compulsive stare. Dorian shook himself back to the present.
"Do you know these things are true?" he asked. "Or are they merely the dreams born of desire?"
Kadam answered straight, without lowering his eyes.
"We have been in council with the desert sheikhs. They, who are often divided, all speak with a single voice. They say, let Al-Salil take his place at the head of our armies, and we will follow wherever he leads."
Dorian stood up abruptly and left the circle around the campfire. None of the others followed him, neither Tom nor Yasmini. He paced along the edge of the water, a romantic figure in his robes, tall and shining in the moonlight. Tom and Sarah whispered together, but the others were silent.
"You must not let him go," Sarah told Tom quietly. "For Yasmini's sake and ours, you lost him once. You cannot let him go again."
"And yet I cannot stop him. This is between Dorian and his god."
Batula packed fresh tobacco in the bowl of the hookah, and it was almost consumed to ash before Dorian came back to the fire. He sat cross-legged with his elbows on his knees and his chin cupped in both hands, staring into the leaping flames.
"My lord," Kadam whispered, "give me your answer. With the trade wind standing fair, if you sail at once, you can mount the elephant throne in Muscat at the beginning of the Feast of Lights. There can be no more propitious day than that to begin your reign as caliph."
Dorian was silent still, and Kadam went on. His tone was not wheedling, but strong and sure of his purpose.
"Your Highness, if you return to Muscat, the mullahs will declare jihad. A holy war against the tyrant. God and all of Oman will be at your back. You cannot turn aside from your destiny.
Dorian raised his head slowly. Yasmini drew a long, slow breath and held it. Her nails sank into the hard muscles of his forearm.
Kedem Aljuf, Dorian replied. This is a terrible decision. I cannot make it alone. I must pray for guidance.
Kedem fell forward, prostrating himself on the sand before Dorian. His arms and legs were spread wide.
God is great, he said. There can be no victory without his benevolence. I shall wait for your answer.
I will give it to you tomorrow night, at this same time and place.
Yasmini let out her breath slowly. She knew that this was only a reprieve, and not a pardon.